From the Danker Studio on Library Square, this is The Rundown, an exploration of local news, current events, and issues that matter to you. Today on the program, we're going to revisit a conversation about public lands policy in the West. The issue has seen a lot of coverage in the press lately with a standoff involving a Nevada rancher over grazing rights on BLM land. And this coming Saturday, a San Juan County commissioner plans an illegal ATV protest ride through a canyon that's been closed by the BLM since 2007 to protect archaeological remains. With renewed focus on the issue, today on The Rundown, we're rebroadcasting an interview with Robert Keiter, professor of law at the University of Utah and director of the Wallace Stegner Center of Land, Resources, and the Environment, who has been following this issue closely for years. That and your top local headlines just ahead on The Rundown. First up, though, these messages and access downtown. And welcome back to The Rundown. I'm Roger McDonough. Coming up later on the show, a conversation about efforts by the state of Utah to wrest control of public lands from the federal government. But first up, we have these headlines. Officials at Zion National Park say someone has been hovering a drone above the park's bighorn sheep. Park volunteers saw a herd of sheep scatter after being buzzed by an unmanned aerial vehicle on the weekend of April 20th and 21st, separating the animals from their young. Park Superintendent Jim Milestone said in a statement on Monday that it is illegal to fly a drone in the park in southwest Utah. Violators could be subject to 6 months in prison and a $5,000 fine. Drones are controlled by embedded computers or by remote control. Rangers have reported a climb in their use within the park in recent months. In addition to harassing sheep and disrupting birds, some visitors have complained that the drones interrupt their wilderness experience. A few have also reported that they feel unsafe. Police have seized several items of furniture from the homes of family members of a Utah woman accused of killing six of her newborns and storing them in her garage. Documents made public Monday show police retrieved a bed, chest of drawers, and various documents after 39-year-old Megan Huntsman told investigators she gave birth to the babies at home and then killed them. The items seized by investigators belonged to Huntsman but had been stored with relatives. Police say Huntsman killed the babies between the years 1996 and 2006. Authorities say a seventh baby found in the garage in April was stillborn. Huntsman was charged last week with six counts of first-degree murder. She has not yet entered a plea. Many of you may be celebrating Cinco de Mayo on Monday, and while many Americans observe the holiday as a day to celebrate Mexican culture, there are quite a few misconceptions about the day's origins and meaning. To help find out the true meaning of Cinco de Mayo, here's KCPW's Ryan Cunningham.
If you're a fan of Mexican cuisine and you're a well-established Salt Lake citizen, then you're probably familiar with Red Iguana. It's a Mexican restaurant on the city's northwest side, and on Monday afternoon, business is booming. That might have something to do with the occasion. It's Cinco de Mayo.
And I think that people just want to come out and do something, you know, that relates to being in Mexico. So they think, oh, yeah, let's go. So, yeah, we're probably about, I would say, about 20% busier.
That's Lucy Cardenas, who co-owns Red Iguana with her husband Bill Coker. Cardenas says there's a lot of business and catering on Cinco. They've even brought in some live music for the day. Orlando Lopez and Fernando Herrera usually play here on Fridays and Saturdays, but they're making an exception for this Monday. There's a celebratory atmosphere all around at Red Iguana, but what exactly is everyone here celebrating? That is, what is Cinco de Mayo?
Okay, what it is a holiday that was invented in the United States, in California, 152 years ago, during the Civil War, in response both to events of the American Civil War and of the French invasion of Mexico, which were happening at the same time.
That's Cynthia L. Chamberlain, historian at the Center for the Study of Latino Health and Culture at UCLA. She says the holiday was created to commemorate a Mexican victory at the city of Puebla, where outnumbered Mexican troops were able to hold off the powerful invading French army. So Cinco de Mayo is not the Mexican Independence Day. That's September 16th. And Chamberlain isn't sure when the confusion began, but she suspects that people interpreted the day in their own ways over time.
For instance, a lot of the Mexican immigrants started to use it as an occasion to put forth their own concerns. So say about the revolution in Mexico, about being immigrants in this country where they weren't terribly welcome, that sort of thing. So they made up new meanings because they didn't know what the original one was.
So is Cardenas bothered if her patrons aren't quite clear on the history or meaning of the day?
No. It's all good. And the fact that we're neighbors and the fact that it's being acknowledged is fine by me. You know, I love it.
And besides, it's good for business. For KCPW News, I'm Ryan Cunningham.
And that does it for our local headlines today. I'm Roger McDonough, and you're listening to The Rundown. Stay with us. And welcome back to The Rundown here on KCPW. I'm Roger McDonough. 2 years ago, Governor Gary Herbert signed into law a request for the federal government to cede control of more than 20 million acres of land to the state of Utah. The text of the Transfer of Public Lands Act begins, "On or before December 31st, 2014, the United States shall A. extinguish title to public lands, and B. transfer title to public lands to the state." Other legislative and legal efforts have followed, and just 2 weeks ago, lawmakers from 8 western states, including speakers of the House from Utah, Idaho, and Montana, gathered in Salt Lake City for a legislative summit on the transfer of public lands. In the meantime, we've seen a standoff involving a Nevada rancher over grazing rights on BLM land, and this Saturday, a San Juan County commissioner plans an illegal ATV protest ride through Recapture Canyon, which has been closed since 2007 to motorized access to protect archaeological sites. In some ways, the tension between the federal government and the states over territory and power is as old as America itself. But with the issue seemingly coming to a head, we thought it was a good time to rebroadcast an interview on the subject of public lands policy in the West with Robert Keiter, a professor of law at the University of Utah and the director of the Wallace Stegner Center of Land, Resources, and the Environment. When I spoke with Professor Keiter back in October, I began the interview by asking him about an op-ed that then-Attorney General John Swallow had penned in support of the transfer of public lands to the state. We've sketched out kind of a big topic for today, but I suppose I'll start by mentioning that the Salt Lake Tribune carried an op-ed by Utah Attorney General John Swallow, in which he renews the argument made by others that Utah is better equipped to manage public lands than the federal government. He states that the case for local control is bolstered by the shutdown of national parks and that the state's negotiated role in reopening these parks is helping to bolster this idea. And one of the arguments that he makes is that, and this is what he writes, I'm quoting, "State, county, and local governments will respond prudently, even-handedly, and in the best interest of the citizens of Utah and all Americans, including in the proper stewardship of our treasured lands." From those comments and from the list of bills in the last legislative session, state officials seem bent on taking over federal public lands. Professor Keiter, is that something that is constitutionally possible?
As a matter of constitutional law, not without congressional legislation. The federal public lands are under the authority of Congress by virtue of what's known as the Property Clause in the United States Constitution. And in interpreting that clause over the years, the Supreme Court has given it a very broad interpretation. In fact, some of the opinions even speak of Congress's authority to control, to regulate, to ensure a proper management of the federal public lands as being without limitation. It's also worth noting that this sort of state interest in securing control over federal public lands is something that has historically been with us. It's part of the tension that's built into our federal state system and has been manifested in such activities as the Sagebrush Rebellion during the late 1970s, the Wise Use Movement during the 1990s, and now we're seeing a third, slightly different iteration of it with the various pieces of legislation that the Utah legislature has passed, the editorial that you alluded to, Roger, and other initiatives. One of the ironies with the current push that seems to be generated, at least in part, part by the closure of the national parks as part of the federal shutdown, is the fact that the national parks are national. They were created in the first instance by Congress, and from the early days of the national park system, the initial director, Stephen Mather, insisted in the rather famous Lane letter issued in 1918 to direct management of these areas that in matters of commerce and public-private relationships, that the national interest must take precedence over the local interest. And that has been a guiding principle for the National Park Service as it has managed its lands ever since its inception almost 100 years ago. It's also noteworthy, I think, that in terms of the shutdown and the crisis that that engendered, that the state's response to that crisis was driven largely by private commercial concerns of the gateway communities and other businesses, including concessionaires, that are responsible for providing services for tourists. And you've got a built-in tension there between the private commercial market-driven interest of these communities, all quite legitimate, I should add, and the public interest in the management of the national parks, which includes not just catering to tourists, but also ensuring that the resources in these special places are fully protected. So the Park Service itself is torn between these two concerns, and from the outset, it has recognized that following and paying attention to the national interest should take priority.
Let's use this as a bit of a side route. You're somebody who has looked both historically and philosophically at the idea of national parks. You have a book called To Conserve Unimpaired, The Evolution of the National Park Idea. How has that idea changed over time? You're talking about that built-in tension between commerce and conservation. But there's more to it than just that.
Well, the origins of the national park idea arguably date back to 1832 when the author and painter George Catlin ventured up the Missouri River and seeing the imminent demise of the Native American population there and the rapid change of the landscape in that area with the advent of white settlers moving into the area, proposed creating, quote, a nation's park in all of native inhabitants and beasts at glory, or a quote quite similar to that. That idea ultimately was transferred into the national park idea in legislation creating Yellowstone National Park in 1872, the first national park in the world, and an idea that has often been called America's best idea by Wallace Stegner and by others. From that time, when the park system got underway, it was managed early on primarily to attract visitors. It was a tourist destination and a place for outdoor recreation. It also was a place where we protected our scenic wonders. Think the Yosemite Valley, the geological features in Yellowstone, and the like. That scenic protection ultimately proved not to be ecologically wise, and we eventually realized that as scientists got more involved in what is entailed in managing a place like a national park, protecting the resources there. And over time, and it took more than half a century, the Park Service began to shift toward more scientific management of its resources. And that is an evolution in the national park idea from scenic preservation to, if you will, ecological type management that recognizes that landscapes are not static entities but are dynamic entities with processes in place that are essential for their long-time integrity and maintenance. For example, early on, the National Park Service put out fires in the national parks. That shifted in the late 60s, early 70s to allow some backcountry fires to burn. Wolves were eliminated. We've brought them back in Yellowstone in the mid-1990s, all reflecting a recognition that science ought to be an important component driving national park management policy. So that's one way in which the national park idea has evolved over time.
Well, and you know what you're talking about there also is an evolution in the way in which management occurs. And you know, frequently at the Utah State Legislature, you hear the term federal mismanagement of lands. And in the wake of the government shutdown, Governor Gary Herbert negotiated a deal with the Department of the Interior in which the state essentially lent the U.S. government the money to reopen national parks here. I'm wondering if you can address if this is setting a precedent. Is the idea that we've negotiated this deal bolstering the idea, as Attorney General John Swallow says, that that the state is better prepared to do this?
Well, first, it's probably important to note, Roger, that the parks shut down not because of any action on the part of the National Park Service. It's Congress that's been responsible for the shutdown, not only of the national parks, but a lot of other federal programs and activities that people rely upon. That said, in terms of the state providing funding to reopen some of the national parks, that is not entirely unusual. There have been other instances where either state or private money has figured prominently in the management of the national parks. Just a few winters ago, in the wake of another budget shortfall for the National Park Service, the state of Wyoming provided some funds to plow roads into Yellowstone a few weeks earlier than the Park Service was in a position to do as a result of its budgetary problems. The private sector was involved in raising the money to refurbish the Statue of Liberty back about 20, 30 years ago. And in fact, if you go far enough back in history, when the Great Smoky Mountains National Park was established on the North Carolina Tennessee border, both of those states actually provided some of the funding to acquire the private lands that were made ultimately into the national park. It's probably worth noting that both states strongly supported the creation of a national park in that location, thinking that it would be a real asset for the local communities, and that, of course, has proven to be true. Great Smoky Mountains National Park is the most heavily visited national park in the entire national park system. So there is some precedent for federal-state cooperation in management of the parks and some of the funding. However, the law, and this is based on some court decisions, is pretty clear that a federal land management agency like the National Park Service cannot relinquish final management decision-making authority over these places to, for example, state officials, even if the state is providing some funding.
When Utah's talking about getting title to these public lands, what specifically are the kinds of lands that they're looking at?
The legislation that the Utah legislature adopted a couple years ago, asserting that the federal government had an obligation to dispose of all of the federal lands, exempted national parks and national monuments and most wilderness areas from that. And therefore, the principal focus was the Bureau of Land Management lands, as well as some of the national forest lands. These are primarily multiple-use lands that are available for a variety of uses, ranging from energy development to wildlife conservation. It would make sense from the state's perspective to perhaps seek disposal of these lands or management oversight of these lands in order to secure financial return to the state's treasury. The problem is that Congress is ultimately responsible for all of these lands, and the claim that the state has pressed in these cases is found in some language in what's known as the Utah Statehood Act, but that language is open to quite a bit of interpretation, and there is other language in the Act that indicates that the state has disclaimed all ownership claims to the federal public lands. The Legislative Services Office that looked at the legislation concluded that it was probably unconstitutional, that federal supremacy clause principles would render state ownership claims a nullity in the face of federal ownership of these lands. My own assessment looking at legislative history surrounding public lands, surrounding statehood, surrounding the language found in the statehood legislation is the same. That is that the state would have a hard time making a legal case that the federal government is obligated to dispose of these lands or alternatively turn them over to the state.
They're basing their attempt at this on the Utah Statehood Act. That was the act that actually granted the state of Utah statehood. Is that right?
That is correct. The Statehood Act contains a lot of different provisions, and a couple of which specifically address public lands.
And so there was at least enough vagary in that language for some state legislators to think that there was a basis for a federal land takeover.
There is some language in the Statehood Act about disposal of the federal public lands. And, of course, that was consistent with federal policy at that point in time. Let's keep in mind that the federal government, in fact, owned these lands from the outset as a result of treaties with Mexico and other foreign nations. So that language is found in the statehood legislation, along with, as I mentioned, quite a bit of other language reflecting a state disclaimer to the federal public lands.
Professor Cutter, we are low on time, but I do have this final question. At the time the Public Lands Act was presented at the state legislature, the Office of Legislative Research and General Counsel said it had a high probability of being declared unconstitutional. And in the past, efforts like these haven't made much headway because of the conflict with federal dominion, with federal law. So why do we keep seeing this issue emerge on the Western stage?
It's a reflection, I believe, of the inherent tension between the federal government and the states that's reflected in our federalist system, which is predicated upon the notion of federalism that you have two sovereigns and they each have roles to play, providing the opportunity for state and local governments to have a voice, to play a role in shaping national policies and politics is an important outlet that helps us in the long run to maintain the peace. And I think it's been established, and most people would agree, that a fully centralized governmental system run at the national level, something along the lines of what perhaps the Soviet Union sought to do, just doesn't work. And our federalist system seeks to take account of local interests as well as national interests. And I think the legislation that you've referred to regarding federal public lands in Utah is an example of how that plays out. So the legislation seeking control of or disposal of the federal lands ultimately, at least in my judgment, reflects more of a political statement than a viable legal strategy for securing ownership of these lands.
Robert Kiter is the Wallace Stegner Professor of Law, University Distinguished Professor, and founding director of the Wallace Stegner Center for Land Resources and the Environment at the S.J. Quinney College of Law at the University of Utah. Thanks very much for coming and helping to illuminate this discussion for us.
It's been my pleasure, Roger. Thank you for having me.
And just a quick note that on May 14th, the Salt Lake Tribune's Jennifer Napier Pierce will moderate a debate between three Utahns in support of current federal lands policy and three in opposition. The debate is free and open to the public at the Salt Lake City Main Library. Again, it's May 14th at 7 p.m. KCPW will broadcast the event live. I'm Roger McDonough, and you're listening to The Rundown. We'll be right back. And thanks again for tuning into The Rundown this afternoon. Our show was produced by Lauren Colucci. And additional help from Ryan Cunningham and Mr. Tyler Ford. Our theme music was composed by Tim Myers. We're on the program, tune in for a conversation about the labeling of organic foods with Kathleen Merrigan, former U.S. Department of Agriculture Deputy Secretary and Director of the Sustainability Institute at the George Washington University. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for listening. The Utah Business Report and Marketplace are next.